This is recorded on the afternoon of July 14th, 1970, in the offices of Dr. Earl Butts of Purdue University, former Dean of Agriculture and Undersecretary of State for Agriculture in the United States of America. This interview is recorded in his offices at the, in the Executive Building at Purdue University and will be used for the university archives. We'll put this on the tape and say it was an Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. All right, Dean Butts, let's start out. Can you summarize briefly your experiences with Purdue, extending from your first coming here in 1928 to the present time? And would you also just briefly bring us up to the time you came to Purdue? Where were you born, your high school education, and so on?
All right. My initial contact with Purdue came before I ever came to this campus. It was in 4-H club work with our county agricultural agent back in Noble County, Indiana. That's where I grew up, on a farm between Albion and Ligonier in Noble County. Graduated from Wauwaka High School, a small high school. They consolidated that 2 years ago, and we just have alumni meetings there now. But those small high schools weren't all bad. It was possible for me there to take the lead in the junior play, the lead in the senior play, to be on the basketball team, to be on the baseball team, to be on the track team, to represent the high school in the district Latin contest and the district mathematics contest, and even to sing a solo part in an opera one time. In those small high schools, you get all kinds of experience. When I graduated, I had a scholarship to Indiana University and had a Rector scholarship to DePauw University, had no scholarship to Purdue. Times were rather difficult in those days, 1927-28, so I laid out of school a year before college. I'd been active in 4-H club work and was a junior 4-H club leader. Our county agent, who later became a professor at the University of Illinois, one day called me up and said, "I'm going down to Purdue, come along." So I rode along down to Purdue, and the very first person he introduced me to was Vern Freeman, who was then a young assistant to the dean in the School of Agriculture. I'll come back to him in just a moment. But as a result of that, I enrolled in Purdue in the School of Agriculture in the fall of 1928. And that brings me up to the time that I hit Purdue. Now, you want me to go ahead now and summarize since that time?
Well, if you'd like to, yes.
All right. I graduated here in 1932, which was the depth of the Depression. That's the year Will Rogers said was the lowest boom he had ever seen. There was nobody hiring seniors those days. I had quite an experience as an undergraduate here. I graduated with distinction. I was 4 years on the exponent staff, being editor-in-chief the senior year. In those days, we had a pretty decent newspaper, we thought. I was 3 years on the varsity debate team. Had to give it up my senior year because of exponent activities. I was in the advanced ROTC here, a student officer there. Had a number of other activities here at the same time. When I graduated, again, things were pretty tough, and I spent a year on the home farm. My father had a job with a local cooperative, and I ran the home farm for a year. A year later, I was offered a graduate assistantship in agricultural economics at Purdue University.
1933.
This paid the magnificent sum of $60 a month, as I recall, and was glad to get it. But the chief thing was it gave me an opportunity to do graduate work in agricultural economics. I had earlier majored in animal husbandry, and therefore had a pretty good production background. And I came down here in ag economics and began working with Dr. E.C. Young, who was then professor of ag econ, later became dean of the graduate school and vice president of the university. I was in graduate school here for 2 years, and had completed what would have been the master's degree, except I was going straight through for the doctorate. Then it came time for my doctor's thesis, and I got a fellowship through Dr. Young with the Federal Land Bank of Louisville, where I was studying the Farm Credit Organization in the four states in the 4th District, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So I spent a year and a half with them, largely on my own, checking with Doc Young sometimes, and developed research with a great deal of travel over those four states that became a PhD thesis. I returned to Purdue University in February 1937 as instructor in what was then the Farm Management Department, finished my thesis and got my doctor's degree in June 1937. Became assistant professor for 2 or 3 years, became associate professor for 2 or 3 years, and in 1946 was named head of the Department of Agricultural Economics when Professor O.G. Lloyd decided to step aside from that post. I was a youngster then, about 36 years old, I believe, to head this rather important department right after the war. We built that department up substantially, enlarged it to build its graduate program from half a dozen graduate students to some 50 or 60 by the time I gave it up 8 years later. In 1954, I left the department on leave to become Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in Washington under Secretary Ezra Benson in the Eisenhower administration. I was there for 3 years, always on leave from Purdue University, but I came back in 1957 when Dean Harry Reid retired as Dean of Agriculture to assume the post of Dean of Agriculture, where I remained for 10 1/2 years until December 31, 1967, when I resigned to seek the Republican nomination for governor in our state. We nominate by convention. This was in June 1968. After 6 months campaigning, there were three of us running for the office. I went to the convention where I got what I facetiously call a resounding mandate to return to academic work. So I came back to the university then as Dean of Continuing Education and Vice President of the Purdue Research Foundation, which post I've been in since then.
That brings us up to date. Now let's go back and talk about what was your interest in agriculture, and quite frankly, let's go into more details. How did you happen to come to Purdue School of Agriculture?
Well, my interest in agriculture was very natural, and I grew up on a farm, a general livestock farm. I was in 4-H club work, had a very keen interest in agriculture, and I think it traces back to my county agent. The reason I came to Purdue, I think, can be traced to my county agent, J.B. Cunningham, who brought me down here. I had a latent interest in medicine or the law, and probably would have gone that route if he had not brought me down here and introduced me to Vern Freeman, who somehow struck a sympathetic chord with me, and the first thing I knew, I was in the School of Agriculture. I've never regretted it.
What were your academic interests? What was your undergraduate major?
I took animal husbandry as an undergraduate major. They call it animal science now. It was a practical course. It gave me a lot of work with livestock and good contact with the livestock leadership in the state, which is among the best of the agricultural leadership in the state. That was my academic interest. My outside interests, as I said, were the student daily, the exponent, the debate team, the agricultural society, a half a dozen honoraries I was in, Iron Key, Sigma Delta Chi, Tau Kappa Alpha, Scabbard and Blade, Skull and Crescent.
What of those activities do you think was the most important to you now that you look back on
it? My undergraduate experience, the three most important things in that, even including my classroom work, the three most important things, I think, were 4 years on the exponent, 3 years on the debate team. Those two activities sharpened my ability to communicate, and advanced ROTC, which sharpened my capacity for leadership and decision making. Now, I got my education as a graduate student, I hasten to say.
I'm interested in your debate because I was president of the debating group in my college.
Which college was that?
Harvard. As you look back on it, what men, when you were undergraduate and graduate, seemed to have the greatest influence on you?
That's a good question. I've already mentioned Vern Freeman. Vern was a young man. He seemed old to me then, but he was only about 9 or 10 years older than I was, perhaps not that much. But I came to him, and he had a lot of enthusiasm for the School of Agriculture, and I found him through my undergraduate days a very willing counselor, and went to him often. And I often think back on those days that he never knew how much good he was accomplishing when his door was always open for students to come in. And he was sympathetic. We put our problems before him. And I'm sure every student has somebody like that in college, and he was that to me. Another one is Professor O.G. Lloyd, who headed the Department of Agricultural Economics, a very kind fellow, and I came to have much respect for him. Was frequently in his home. He had a habit always of inviting the students, the undergraduate students in the Alpha Gamma Rho fraternity, who made the distinguished student rating, to come to his house for dinner. And I was over there twice a year usually and got to know his family. Another one was E.C. Young, a great teacher. I became acquainted with him as an undergraduate, and I think he more than anybody else inspired me to take graduate work in agricultural economics. I'd also have to list Professor James Hugh McKee in this list. He taught English. I had two courses with him. One was a freshman course in journalism I took as an overload my second semester, and thought the world of Jim McKee. I took a second course with him. He was a great teacher, and he stands out as one of my great teachers. And in that group, I'd also have to list Dr. Elliott, the president of Purdue, and Frank Hockema, his assistant, who later became vice president. And I got to know both of them quite well as undergraduates and was extremely fond of them.
Do you have any memories of Elliott that are outstanding?
Oh, yes, indeed. He was a hard-nosed college president. Whatever was good for Purdue was foremost for Elliott. He was ruthless. He was competent. He was imaginative. He was hard-nosed with students sometimes, but I was one of the student leaders.
Well, we had to go off the tape for a moment. Let's go back. We were talking about Edward C. Elliott and other men who had been influential in your graduate student.
I was very close to Doc Elliott as an undergraduate, and he was a tremendous guy. And took a great interest in me, and again as a graduate student and as a young staff member, I think he had a tremendous impact on my attitude toward education and toward the economy in general. I think he was a great president of Purdue University. He was ruthless in building Purdue. He sometimes would sacrifice individuals for building Purdue. In that respect, I think he's different from President Hovde. Fred Hovde is very, very fair to individuals. He'll go out of his way to protect staff members or deans or department heads. Old Doc Elliott would have sacrificed him if it would advance Purdue, but he really advanced Purdue University.
How come that you got into agricultural economics as your field of graduate study?
Oh, two or three things. It was a new field at that time. It was developing. It held great promise. I think the chief reason was, as an undergraduate, Dr. E.C. Young was one of my great teachers. He was an inspiring teacher. And I guess you've studied, you go into fields where you know somebody that you admire and who has had a great influence on you, and I expect that he, more than anybody else, was responsible for my becoming an agricultural economist. He was chairman of my graduate committee for the PhD. He was chairman of my thesis committee. He nursed me along, and as a young staff member, I depended on him a great deal for counsel. I expect he probably had more impact on my professional life than any other individual.
While you were a graduate student, did you have any unusual experiences, or was there anything that was a little out of the ordinary in the way you got your degree or your degree itself?
Oh, yes. As a graduate student, the graduate school was young then. I think it was just formed in 1928, and this was 1934 and 5 when I was a graduate student. They had trouble filling Cary Hall in those days with undergraduates. There were just two units at Cary Hall. Somebody decided that we better have it full if we can recover the marginal operating costs, so they gave a chance to graduate students to live in Cary Hall for $20 a month. That was board and room in those days. I think the full price was $33 a month. There were about 30 graduate students lived in there, and we formed some friendships in that group that have lasted through life, that cut clear across all the schools of the university. Some of those boys have since become vice president of Lilly, vice president of various other concerns, deans, and college presidents. We had a small number of graduate students in ag economics then, only about a half a dozen. It gave us a chance to work closely with the staff that graduate students don't have now. And I think my real opportunity came in my thesis, where I was on my own, traveling some 10 or 12,000 miles with the Federal Land Bank of Louisville, interviewing people out in the field. This was a tremendous experience.
What was the title of your thesis?
I made a study of the National Farm Loan Associations and the 4th Farm Credit District. These have later become what's known as the Federal Land Bank Association. These are the local cooperatives through which Federal Land Bank loans were made to farmers. I made this study at a time when the basic question faced the Farm Credit Administration in Washington, whether they should save the National Farm Loan Associations or flush them out and start over again. And I think our study had had a real impact on the decision to rehabilitate them and strengthen them, which has made the Federal Land Bank system one of the very strong units of farm credit agencies.
When you became an instructor and you went up through the ranks to professor and head of the department, what was the most outstanding problem? What was your tough problem? What did you have to solve? Did you make any changes in curriculum or in structure of teaching?
Yes, I enjoyed undergraduate teaching, Bob, and as I look back, I taught for 17 years before I left to go to Washington. As I look back on my professional career, those were some of the most satisfying days of my entire professional career. I was young, I was close to students, I loved students. I think they liked my classes. Still, one of the thrills I get as I go to public meetings around Indiana is to see my former students in the audiences, and sometimes even yet I ask for a show of hands of how many were in my classes, and I get a real thrill seeing 10 or a dozen or 15 hands go up in these audiences around the state and seeing people who have been successful. I taught, we didn't have many teachers in ag economics in those days, and I had to, we worked hard in those days. I recall one semester, I'd been here just a year and a half, and Dr. Young took off suddenly for a semester at the University of Chicago. And during that semester, I had two sections of the freshman class of 50 students each, with each section having two lectures and a two-hour lab. Incidentally, the chap who was a graduate student that year that graded my papers was Clifford Hardin, who is the current Secretary of Agriculture. We often kid each other about that. I had two sections of the freshman course. I taught a course in farm law, a three-hour lecture course for about 25 students. I taught a course in advanced farm management for about 40 students. I had a course in real estate appraisal. I had a course in advanced statistics, and I also had an 8 weeks winter course in farm management. I think I had either 22 or 24 contact hours in class that semester, a good deal of preparation work at home. I know I told my wife we'd cancel everything this semester, I've got a job to do. As I think back on that in those days, I wasn't complaining because I had to teach more than the 9 hours we talk about now. I thought it was a great privilege.
And fun.
It was real fun. If you enjoy teaching, it's tremendous fun.
Did you have any problems as head?
Oh, yes.
Staffing and administrative problems?
What department head wouldn't have problems? But prior to becoming head, I served on the usual number of committees around the university here, including the old executive committee, I believe they called it, that that met here in the trustees' room. It was mostly deans in those days, with President Elliott presiding, but the faculty each year elected two representatives, and I was one time elected for a tour on that. As department head, we had to build a staff. It was in the immediate post-war period. I became department head in 1946. We built a staff of youngsters. We built our graduate program. I was traveling a great deal in those days. I was an officer of Alpha Gamma Rho fraternity, and that took me to most of the land-grant colleges. And I used those trips to recruit graduate students. I recall we had a battery of graduate students right after the war over there, and let me name them for you, in ag economics. That group included Dr. John Hicks, who is currently the executive assistant to President Hovde, Dick Coles, who's the current dean of agriculture, Howard Dieslin, who's the current director of the Cooperative Extension Service, Dr. Ray Wilson, who is the current director of marketing activities in the agricultural division here in the state, Dr. Cliff Cox, who is current group vice president of Armour & Company in Chicago, drawing over $100,000 a year salaries on their board of directors. The truth of it is I can't recall right now, but in that group of post-war graduate students, we had a battery of young bulls in the pen that have really turned out to be first-class breeders, if I can use my agricultural terminology.
What were your outside interests while you were doing on this, or did you find time for any?
Oh, yes. I've always maintained an interest in agricultural credit, for example, because that was my thesis. And I worked very closely with banking groups during those times. We organized the agricultural clinic of the Indiana Bankers Association that meets here each spring with about 500 attending. This is the outstanding one in the nation. We organized a Production Credit Association seminar here. We had a real estate investment seminar here for two or three years. I spoke a great deal to banking organizations around the circuit. I served as an advisory member of the Agricultural Commission of the American Bankers Association. I was on various commissions of the Federal Land Bank System in Washington. I took a leave of absence in 1943-44 for 10 months to go to Washington, where I was with the Brookings Institution studying the production credit system for farmers. This was published in a book by the Brookings Institution the next year. The following year, I took a part-time leave of absence to be with the National Bureau of Economic Research in New York City, where I was helping to organize a national research project in agricultural finance that covered a variety of subjects.
You were kept very busy professionally. Now, ultimately, recognition was taken of that, and you were asked to become Assistant Secretary of Agriculture. Would you tell us about that experience and working with Mr. Benson, President Eisenhower, and others?
That was a very interesting experience. I went to Washington in July of 1954. The Eisenhower administration was just a year and a half old then. To become Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in charge of marketing and foreign agriculture in the Benson administration. Secretary Benson was a very interesting chap to work for. He was deeply religious. He had been he'd spent most of his life in cooperative work, but for some years prior to this was a member of the Council of 12 of the Mormon Church in Salt Lake City. He was a man of firm conviction, deeply religious. He derived a great tower of strength from his close association to his God. It gave him firm resolve when he was right and made it almost impossible to change him when he was wrong. And even people like that are wrong sometimes. President Eisenhower was very fond of Secretary Benson. Secretary Benson often came under political fire from various politicians, including the then Vice President, who was Richard Nixon, the current President of the United States. But he was close to President Eisenhower. Eisenhower respected his integrity. He liked him for what he stood for. And backed him the limit. Sometimes other presidents would have dumped Secretary Benson, I'm quite sure. This made it a pleasant place to work. I frequently attended cabinet meetings presided over by President Eisenhower, both in the cabinet room at the White House and sometimes up at Camp David when he was meeting up there. I was very close to the White House staff. I traveled abroad a great deal in this assignment since the agricultural attachés were under my jurisdiction. When I first came to Washington, one of the first jobs we had was to organize the so-called PL 480, the Public Law 480, which provided for the sale of surplus farm commodities for foreign currencies. This was a major undertaking, and I think has been a great thing for America and for our total foreign aid program and foreign economic development program around the world.
Has it been continued?
Oh yes, it's continued right now. Just last winter, I was a member of the so-called Peterson Task Force, appointed by President Nixon to make recommendations on our total foreign assistance program. And this sale of surplus agricultural commodities for foreign currencies continues to be one of the major cornerstones of our total foreign assistance program.
What were your other duties as assistant?
Well, I was in charge of marketing, which meant I had the Agricultural Marketing Service reporting directly to me. That's the large governmental agency that does a lot of regulatory work, grading fruits, vegetables, meats, the meat inspection division, the consumer marketing service, the school lunch program, the food stamp program, the surplus commodity distribution program. I suppose I've given away more free food in my life than anybody else who ever lived, and not only because I had the job for 3 years. It was a major responsibility and tied right in with our foreign agricultural work because much of that food was distributed abroad, but much of it was distributed in this country through various charitable and eleemosynary organizations. Our program was the forerunner to the food stamp program, which Secretary Hardin is expanding rather markedly at the present time.
Is it true that we were indifferent to the sufferings of the poor and behind of the communist countries, or was it impossible for us to work with them?
No, we weren't indifferent to the sufferings of the poor. As a matter of fact, when I was there, we had some PL 40 agreements with Poland, I remember, and with Yugoslavia. Now, Yugoslavia is communist, but they're a kind of officially independent brand of communist with Tito there, you know. And somebody once remarked, well, Tito is a red, but he's our red. And as long as he
just... Those weren't the words used, but...
No, we used something else, but I think it made good sense. He's officially independent. He stood up against Moscow. And I recall when I was there, there was some question about Italy, whether Italy would go communist or be in the Western world. And I worked very closely with the ambassador in Italy, Claire Booth Luce, a tremendous woman who was ambassador there at that time. The Food and Agriculture Organization headquarters in Rome, 3 times I chaired the U.S. delegation to conferences to that organization in Rome. In those days, over half of the mayors in Rome and the municipalities in Italy were communist. I recall one time going with a friend of mine who was high up in the Italian government to visit the Roman Chamber of Deputies, they called it, would be our House of Representatives. And some constitutional issue was up that day. It was all Italian, of course, but my friend was interpreting. And I recall seeing the communists sitting clear over on this side of the gallery. Next were the socialists, next were the social democrats, next were the monarchists, and next were somebody else. But the communists were under strict discipline there. They checked with their leader, who had just been to Moscow. They voted as a bloc. But we put a lot of food into Italy during those days through our ambassador, Claire Booth Luce. And I am sure that that surplus American food was a major factor in winning Italy to be a part of the Western group of nations.
Would you care to make any comments about your contacts with President Eisenhower?
Yes, I admired Eisenhower very, very much. Dwight Eisenhower was a man who who had achieved everything, I guess. There's no reason why he should have taken 8 more years out of his life to be president. He'd been general of the armies. He'd been president of Columbia University. He formed NATO and was the first commander in charge of NATO in Paris when President Truman asked him to assume that. And the man deserved some easy years of life. But he was such a fiercely loyal American that when the call came to serve again, he offered himself. He regarded the presidency as a sacred trust. I recall I often helped on writing presidential speeches, especially where agriculture was going to be involved. And I recall one time over in the White House, we had, I think, next to the last draft of that speech, and Sherman Adams, who was the administrative assistant to Eisenhower, was chairing the group, and I had written a short paragraph that I thought had a pretty good political punch in it. And I wrote this, and I said, let's put this in the speech. And Adams says, Well, Earl, that's a good statement. That's an awful good statement. The only trouble is the old man won't say it. And I said, why? He said, well, he thinks the presidency is above partisan politics of that kind. This made him rather difficult sometimes for the political managers, because after all, in our system, the president is also the political manager of his party. And I think President Eisenhower always found it somewhat against his taste to take an active role in political leadership, although he did campaign sometimes. He was often criticized for not campaigning as vigorously as he might have in the election of 1958, or 1960 that would be, when Mr. Nixon was defeated by Mr. Kennedy. But he was a great guy. He believed in delegating responsibility. He delegated a lot of responsibility to his cabinet members. When he ran cabinet meetings, he ran it just like he would chief of staff of the army, I think. Things would come up there that I know he hadn't thought about for many years. He'd been in the army and he'd been in Paris. He had the knack of asking 2 or 3 questions that would go right to the core of the issue. He'd get the information he needed, he'd make a decision, he'd move on. He was a man of quick decisions and firm decisions.
Did you have much contact with President Nixon when he was vice president?
Yes. Richard Nixon always attended the cabinet meetings. He sat right across the big oval table from the president. He always attended legislative leaders' meetings on Tuesday mornings, and I frequently attended those meetings, and frequently committee sessions involving policy questions or political matters, usually. He was there. I became rather well acquainted with him and developed a tremendous respect for him, too. He was kind of the political hatchet man for Eisenhower, just like Agnew now is the political hatchet man for Nixon. I guess this is the role of the vice president anyway.
Did you meet Kennedy or know Kennedy, get to know President Kennedy at all?
I met Jack Kennedy when he was a senator. I never got well acquainted with him, but at least we had a speaking acquaintance. And I was with him a time or two during the campaign and prior to the campaign when he was still a senator before he got the nomination. He was a tremendous personality, a great intellect, perhaps one of the most intelligent men, I suspect, with a keen perception ever to sit in the White House.
You mentioned your work in Italy. Were there any other special assignments that you had when you were with the USDA?
Oh, yes. I traveled abroad a great deal. I guess I was abroad a half a dozen times. I was in London frequently, usually on arrangements involving agricultural exports or sales of commodities. I made contacts like that in the Netherlands, for example, with Mansholt, who was then Minister of Agriculture in the Netherlands. He's now head of the agricultural division of the European Common Market Arrangement there in Brussels, a very brilliant chap. I was over to the International Exposition in Tokyo, for example, a trade fair there. A number of contacts around the world like that. And I may say frequently in contact with the Canadians on this sticky problem of our concessional sales of wheat eating into the Canadian, to the normal Canadian wheat market.
And you studied these sort of things pretty much when you were at Purdue. Did Purdue's work and your work here prepare you for this?
Oh, sure. I spent my life in ag economics here and in agriculture and my travels around the United States. I'd been in nearly all the states of the United States before I went to Washington. I knew the college personnel quite well. I knew a great many business leaders. It made it easy to pick up the telephone in Washington and call somebody in Fresno, California, or Denver, or Atlanta, or Lafayette, or Ithaca, or wherever it may be, and say, look, here's a problem. Can we be of some help? Or if I got into a particularly sticky political problem, I could call somebody and would often call somebody to bring pressure on me to do something that I wanted to do but found it difficult to do, and you can generate pressure in the country for that, you know, and make it easier.
Well, fine. Now, but you gave all this up in 1957 to become Dean of Agricultural here.
Well, that's right. Well, I took the position of Assistant Secretary of Agriculture reluctantly, I guess, although I'm glad I did it. My friends used to ask me, how did you get that post? But I drugged my feet when Secretary Benson was trying to persuade me to come to Washington. He had asked me to come down and talk with him, which I had done. I'd not made any noise about it around here. It hadn't gotten in the papers. President Hovey knew that this was taking place, and Dean Reed knew it was taking place, and I was dragging my feet. And one day Benson was trying to get me on the phone, and I didn't take the call for 3 days. And he finally got a hold of Dean Reed and said, persuade him to come. He got a hold of Hovey, and I went over to talk to President Hovey. And Hovey says, well, I've regarded only one calling higher than education, and that's government. He said, I think you ought to take it. I wasn't aware of it then, but Hovey was really training a dean to succeed Harry Reid. As I look back on it, I know quite well what he was doing. He felt that 3 years as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture would be excellent background for somebody to succeed Harry Reid. And while he'd made no commitment to me on that, I knew that's what he had in mind. And frankly, it's what I had in mind, too, when the opportunity came to come back into educational work in a great university in a state I love. I came back.
Well, I think that, after all, you continued to serve for 10 and a half years as Dean of Agriculture. Would you tell us something about what you think you achieved and some of the changing problems of agriculture that you, with which you had to deal, and the changing in education in agriculture?
Yes, when I came back here in 1957, agriculture was really in the process of changing from a way of life to a way of making a living. I grew up in an agriculture where half of our people were in agriculture. It was a lot of handiwork, a lot of hard work. Productivity per man was relatively low. It was just beginning to become mechanized at that time. When I came back here in 1957, I'd say we were just then entering into the era of undergirding agriculture with tremendous amounts of science and technology. The productivity per worker was zooming. The number of workers was decreasing. The amount of capital employed in agriculture was increasing a great deal. The demand for technical knowledge and research was greater than ever before. We were on a fast track. Research in agriculture was was widely accepted and well accepted by the American public. It was going good at Purdue. I had the full support of President Hovey here, and I think they were a great 10 years. Dean Reed ahead of me had supported his department heads in building a good, strong staff of youngsters in the post-war era. They were just coming in their own when I came back here. And I think I had a wonderful time to be Dean of Agriculture.
Didn't we make some great contributions to the agriculture of other countries?
Oh, yes.
Colombia?
Oh, yes, indeed. We had had a contract with AID in Washington to develop the agricultural college in Brazil, but it's kind of been faltering along. And shortly before I left Washington, I went over to the AID people and I said, let's either get that thing on the track or park it. And shortly after I came back here, three of us went down for a 2 weeks visit in Brazil. Out of that grew the rather tremendous program we have had with with Viçosa, with Rural University of Viçosa in Brazil. We've now had some 40 or 50 of our staff members down there. We have the largest contingent of Portuguese-speaking members of our staff of any place in the United States right here who've been in Brazil. They know it. I think they made a great contribution. We did some other things
in
agriculture.
Well, that developed ultimately developed the backlands of Brazil.
Well, we're developing an institution down there, a land-grant college prototype down there that can do for Brazil what the land-grant colleges have done for agriculture in this country, and I think they're off to a good start. There were other things we did during those 10 years. We completely revised our curriculum in agriculture early in those 10 years. We cut out some of the busy work. We made it less vocational-oriented, more scientific. We undergirded with more communication, with more mathematics. We used to require 9 hours of English or speech. That was stepped up to 15 hours of English, speech, or modern language. And modern language is not a bad way to pick up your own English, as you know. I think we strengthened our curriculum a great deal. And furthermore, I set out to give dignity to agriculture here, to make our agriculturists proud of being in agriculture, to make our students proud of being agricultural students. And I also set as my goal to become Mr. Agriculture in the state. I think I fairly well succeeded in that. In a state like this, the deans of professional schools have to be more than deans. They have to be nursemaid to their profession throughout the state, too. If they don't get out and mix with it, they don't get the support they need from the profession in many, many quarters. So I spent a great deal of time getting around this state. During my 10 years as dean, I was in every one of our 92 counties in this state at least once to speak to county or regional meetings, and most of them many, many times of the more populous counties. And I still get around to meetings of that kind. I think this did a great deal to build public support and understanding for our agricultural program at Purdue and to build acceptance of what we were trying to do here. We early reversed the downward trend in agricultural enrollment that had been taking place around the circuit and built up an increase in agricultural enrollment here, in many cases leading the nation, until we've now got an ag school in terms of undergraduate enrollment that ranks either second or third in the nation. In terms of graduate enrollment, it's just about the same size.
But you presided then at this change from work in the sense to the orientation towards scientific and administrative use of land.
Yeah, as dean I did. Not alone the use of land, but then agriculture is much broader than the use of land. It includes agribusiness, too. This whole business of processing, distributing, of supplying farmers with the things they need for their production items. But I have to say that we had a wonderful group of department heads over there that were fully cooperative, and a great gang of professors and research workers dedicated to public service.
Let me ask you something while we're at it, just for the fun of it. Would you rate Purdue School of Agriculture in the United States along with others?
Well, I'd rate it easily in the top half dozen, Bob. Now, beyond that, it's hard to pick out the top one. One's good in one field, another one's good in another field. But I'd rate this, without fear of successful contradiction, easily in the top half dozen, in terms of quality and in terms of size.
That'd be like Ames in Iowa, Cornell.
I'd put them in the top half
Davis,
dozen.
Davis, California.
I don't know whether I'd put Davis there or not, but I'd put Cornell, Michigan State, Ames, probably Minnesota.
Ohio?
Maybe not in the top half dozen.
All right. I asked this for the record because I ask everybody, how do you rate, you know, but that's all right. Why shouldn't I put it there?
But I'd rate Purdue there stronger in some departments and not as strong in others, but as an entity, easily in the top half dozen. In my book, that's good enough.
Would you care to say in what specialties you think we're strongest?
Well, yes. We've got my old Department of Ag Economics is rated by everybody in the top two or three in the country. They're not theoretical, they're more applied, although they're good in theory, too. But this is a top-flight department with a large undergraduate enrollment and a large graduate enrollment. Animal sciences is good. During my tenure as dean, we combined three departments, the poultry, the dairy, and the animal husbandry departments, to make the Department of Animal Sciences. It's a strong department, well-staffed. I think our biochemistry department is good. It's well-staffed. Entomology is excellent. Dr. Osmond became head of entomology just before I returned as dean and has done a tremendous job of taking the department from a low ebb to making it one of the nation's really top departments. I think those are probably the outstanding departments.
Well, I'm interested. That's very interesting. Now, I notice that along with this, you develop political ambitions. We know that you ran for governor. Would you just take this political side of your life and talk about it, your interest in politics and the Republican Party?
Yes, Bob. I grew up in a Democratic family, incidentally, up in Noble County. And the first time I voted was 1932. I voted for Mr. Roosevelt, but I guess that was mostly a protest vote against whoever was in at that time. But shortly after that, when Mr. Roosevelt tried to pack the Supreme Court and did some other things that didn't go down with me very well, I gradually changed allegiance until I become a very active Republican. That isn't to say that everybody in the Republican Party pleases me either, but that's also true of some people in my church, I guess. I don't please them. I've got a feeling that every citizen should participate in government and should participate in his political party, the party of his choice. And I always told my students that I wanted them to get active in the party of their choice, be it Democrat or Republican, I didn't care which, that I wanted competent people to become active in their political parties and to run them. I often, in my public utterances, I often quote Plato, who 2,000 years ago said, the price that men pay for not being interested in politics, the price that men pay for not being interested in politics is to be governed by men worse than themselves. And I think that's absolutely right. So that I've had a growing interest in politics. It was sharpened, I guess, by my tour in Washington for 3 years, where I was there essentially as a professional agriculturist, but you can't be an assistant secretary appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate without also participating in politics. And I did. I campaigned in some states, in congressional campaigns and senatorial campaigns. I came back here and was active in with a local political organization. I made some Lincoln Day speeches around the country. I tried to make them as non-political as you could. I tried to make them at a fairly sophisticated level. I didn't call anybody any names. They were positive in their approach. And I think you should take a positive approach to government. So
you think our present vice president is doing that?
Well, I think so. Our present vice president, he articulates the feelings of a lot of people, I'll say that. He's the most popular fundraiser that either political party has had in a long while. He's practically as good as Bob Kennedy was for the Democrats, I think. And I know that he steps on some toes around here, but maybe he's done some good, too, in getting more objective news reporting. I hope he has. I think I've seen more objective news reporting as a result of this. But as I said a while ago, I think vice presidents really are the hatchet man, the political hatchet man for the president. The president's got to be president of all the people. And I think Nixon's trying to do that. I think Johnson tried to do that, and Kennedy tried to do that. I know Eisenhower tried to do that. And that means, therefore, that you've got to have a hatchet man somewhere, because you've got to have political organization. That's the very essence of the way we govern ourselves. And the vice president's a good man for that, and I think Agnew has turned out to be that. He's popular, he's raising money like mad, and this is a very essential part of political organization, as you know. I think, in a sense, Humphrey was that for when he was vice president, that he did a good deal of the same thing, you know.
Now, you went for the governorship. Why the governorship?
Oh, two or three things. That the governors are important people. They're powerful people. They should be, although the Indiana governor is not as powerful as the governor is in some other states, chiefly because he doesn't appoint many of his cabinet. They're elected, like we elect Secretary of State and Auditor and Treasurer and Superintendent of Public Instruction and the judges. But I had a feeling that there was a chance for greatness in Indiana. We needed to restructure our revenue system. We needed more adequate state finances than we now have, because after all, you can't run a state without money. We've got too high a share of our total cost of government saddled on real estate, principally local educational costs. I have a very firm conviction that we need to shift a much larger share of our primary and secondary educational costs to a broad state-based revenue system and take it off of property. I think our property taxes are so high in this state that it's stifling economic growth in Indiana. This is no longer a good state in which to make business investment.
Or to come in and start small business.
Your tax burden, it kills you relative to other states. And I sit on three or four corporate boards of directors, and I see how we make decisions on where we locate a two or three or a $15 million investment. And taxes are an important item. We've lost too many businesses from this state to other states. I think Indiana had a chance for greatness. I don't want to pay any more taxes than anybody else does. I feel happy when I've got my taxes paid, don't have to worry about it. On the other hand, we've got to recognize that government does perform essential services, and it costs money. And you can't do it without money. Our highway system, for example, in this state is inadequate. We've lagged in the construction of our interstates and our feeder roads. I took the position in the campaign for governor that I would recommend that we change our constitution, which now forbids Indiana to go in debt. I think we ought to be able to go in debt for capital purposes. What a shame that we couldn't have gone in debt $100 million 15 years ago for a highway system. We'd have it today at a third the cost of today, at a saving of many, many thousands of lives.
And it's
also, and by the same token, what a shame we can't do it today the way costs are escalated, because we can do it cheaper today than we can 10 years from now.
It's the same thing with your educational institutions.
Absolutely. We've been living out of inventory in our educational institutions, our state parks, our mental institutions, our correctional institutions. I've been in the state prison at Michigan City, not as an inmate, you understand, but some years back, three or four years ago, I gave the commencement address up at Michigan City, at the state prison at Michigan City. And it was a tremendous experience. We were inside the walls in the auditorium, and these chaps had graduated from high school and from the eighth grade, some of them in their 30s. Got in there, they were killers. My wife and I sat on the stage there, and we had murderers right behind us there. And after we got through, I asked the warden, can we have a little tour of the grounds, and he did. And I want to tell you, it's a shame the way Indiana has not kept up her institutions. You can live out of inventory for a while. For a while, you can get by without replacing the roofs and the foundations and the broken glasses and the toilets, but someday you've got to do it. And we've been doing that in this administration. We did it during the Brannigan administration. We did it during the Welch administration.
I must say, I am registered as a Democrat. I'm really an independent. I am never so shocked and disappointed as I was in Governor Brannigan's administration. He did nothing.
Well, I'm very fond of Roger Brannigan.
I like him too personally.
I have been for years, and I think Roger is a tremendous fellow. But Roger's philosophy really is hold the line on government. Now, I think you've got to hold a tight rein on government, but everything government does is not evil. There are some good things government does, and it costs money. And you ask why I sought the governorship. I guess that's the reason that I think Indiana had a chance for greatness, and we muffed it. Matter of fact, we've been muffing it for years.
I'll tell you what impressed me. I was born and brought up in a conservative community in Nebraska, but what impressed me in Indiana was that there seemed to be a state that was balanced. Small towns, large towns, and a very balanced economy. Now, I don't think I can say that.
Well, I guess that's right. We've changed, of course. We're no longer, we don't have the balance we once had, but here's Indiana that sits in mid-America. We're within an overnight's truck haul of nearly half the population of the United States, or at least two-fifths the population of the United States. A tremendous market just overnight away from us. We've got the good transportation. You can't cross America east-west if you're going anyplace without crossing Indiana.
Us.
You can't cross us north-south if you're going anyplace without going through us. We got good water transportation on the south and on the north. A good resource of people. We ought to take off, but we're not taking off. Ohio's moving faster than we are. Illinois is moving faster than we are. And I think Michigan isn't, even Kentucky. And as a Hoosier, I'm not very proud of that. And I ask why. And I think it's primarily because that our total governmental program is not structured properly. And I guess that's the reason I sought
you
the
need
governorship.
We need a new state constitution back.
Well, we need that too.
I guess that's
one of the reasons I sought the governorship, that I was egotistical enough to think that I might give some leadership in this important area.
Well, I don't see any reason why that's egotistical, because you should have some idea of your abilities. Let's come back here to Purdue for a moment. You've been here in an administrative capacity about as long as Fred Hubde. Would you care to comment on his administration and the developments that you've had part in, or that you've observed at Purdue under Hubde?
Well, yes. He's been here going on 25 years now. I was a pretty new department head when he came here. Or maybe I was made department head after he came. I don't know. When did he come? In
1945.
45. Well, then I was made department head the next year, I guess. And I was 8 years department head. Of course, there was a dean between him and me, but then I was gone 3 years, and 10.5 years as dean working with President Hovde. He's a great fellow to work with in my book. He delegates responsibility. When I came here as dean, I know we laid down the ground rules, and I came to him and I said, "Now this is the way I want to work," and so we understood each other. And he said, "Now I've got you as dean of agriculture. You run the ag school. And when I can help you, call on me. Just keep me out of trouble, alert me to things that may go wrong, and run it the way you want to, with one or two exceptions." He had a couple of political items that were sensitive, and he said, "We'll have to take care of these out in the state." He's created a great image for Purdue University. He has a national reputation.
What he did was to preside at the change from Purdue as being a small applied science
right.
school to a huge, nationally and internationally known university.
And his watchword has always been excellence. If we do it at all, let's do it right. And he's insisted on that. Mm-hmm. His track record during his 25 years is tremendous in terms of growth, in terms of buildings, in terms of financial support. Take the vet school, for instance. He was besieged many times to start a school of veterinary medicine. He took the position, "I won't do it until I get the financial support to do it right." And I suppose he could have started 10 years earlier. But he said, "If we can't do it right, we won't do it at all," and it was done right. Or take the School of Industrial Management. It's only 10 years old now. In those 10 years, it's become in the top league in these schools in America. This is rather remarkable, I think.
Well, and I think he's dealt with a very difficult problem in engineering. In a time when so much of engineering education has been going away from applied
That's
science
right.
to theory, I think he's done well there.
That's right.
Being in the School of Humanities, I think it's difficult to know what to do with that one. But I think his science is excellent.
His science is excellent, but humanities has prospered under President Hovde, and I know sometimes they're critical of him. But when he came here, Dr. Elliott was paying English professors just enough to prevent starvation, because there wasn't much else an English professor could do in those days, or a modern language instructor, or a mathematics instructor. I recall in the early days hearing President Hovde say, "Well, we're going to treat them like full-fledged members of the faculty. This is very essential." And I've heard Hovde many a time insist that students in professional schools must also have a good, broad, general education. And I think the humanities school has grown a great deal under Hovde. They've grown relatively faster than most any other school around here, so fast, in fact, that some members of the professional schools are critical of them.
This is very true. Of course, I hear this every day. And I think Hovde is not given enough credit for working with the library and building up our resources.
For an engineer, Hovde has had a great appreciation of humanities, of culture, of adequate library facilities. And I have marveled at the understanding he has for the need for development in those areas.
And the success of any administrator is his ability to work with men and to work with the students. There seems to be a tendency towards polarization between students and faculty today.
Yeah, not along between students and faculty, but among the faculty themselves. Just last night I was with one of my friends on the faculty. He's an engineering professor, a mechanical engineer, about my age. And he said, "You know, it used to be fun to work on the Purdue faculty, and I'm kind of glad I'm approaching retirement age," he said. Now maybe that's part of the generation gap. But in the early days it was fun to work on the faculty. There was a sense of unity and a sense of purpose among our people. We didn't have activists among us. Now we're polarized. There are those who feel that one function of the university is to engender activism and to take the lead in it.
By activism, you mean to use the university as a political springboard?
That's right.
Platform.
That's right. I personally think that universities get themselves in trouble when they do that, as Purdue University has gotten in trouble. That when the university invades politics, you must expect politics to invade the university.
This is bad, because the university should be a place for discussion and dialogue.
That's absolutely right. I think the business of the university is to deal in truth, in its discovery, in its refinement, in its promulgation. The function of the business world, of the non-academic world, is to deal in political change and politics, to deal in profits if you're in the business world. And when the university, as a university, espouses a cause, that has social or political overtones, they tend to lose their objectivity. They tend to lose the respect of the electorate. They tend to lose the confidence their followers ought to have in them for objective analysis.
All right, let me ask you the tough one. How do you analyze the black problem here and all the commotion created? I read here a libel on my department that is in the debris for 1970.
I haven't read that. I've read it. What is it?
It said that the courses in history at Purdue University were constructed on prejudiced, racist lines.
Well, I haven't had your courses in history since I was an undergraduate here, and I think the course I had then was Charlie Murphy, who taught the history of the South. And I think if anybody would have been prejudiced in those days, it would have been Charlie Murphy. But as I recall, it was a very objective, analytical job. Louis Sears was... You didn't know Louis Sears.
I knew him very well.
But Louis Sears was a great teacher here during the early years of the Roosevelt administration. He hated Roosevelt with a personal passion.
He wouldn't even take a Roosevelt dime.
That's right. Everything that Roosevelt stood for was almost poison to Louis Sears. Yet when President Roosevelt died, I recall that President Elliott decided to have a convocation in his honor in the Hall of Music, and this was obviously going to be a big thing, and he had to have a convocation speaker, and he called up Louis Sears. He said, would you be able to give an objective analysis, an objective tribute to President Roosevelt? And Louis says, I think I can. And I went to hear that. And to this day, I remember what a terrific job Louis Sears did. And I knew how he felt, for we had discussed this personally many times. But here was a man who was able to disassociate his personal feelings and prejudices from the page of history and to make an analysis that I think was a terrific one as he tried to project the place in history that Franklin Roosevelt would have. Now, frankly, I think that's true of your history department. I think we.
You see, this is polarization, though.
I know it's polarization.
This is your blacks.
But this is unfortunate. Now then, you can't rewrite history. We've got a black chapter in American history on the American Negro slave. I'm not proud of it. I'm very ashamed of it. And they've been mistreated. They've been badly treated. They haven't had educational opportunities, and they haven't had economic opportunities.
The same thing with the poor whites.
But that history is written.
Same thing with the poor whites, too.
The same thing with the poor whites. But that history is written. And I think if any professor of history in his course tries to rewrite history, he's performing a tremendous disservice to his students and his profession.
What about the general attitude on the campus, these sleep-ins and so on? This is part of the polarization.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, I've got to admit that I associate with those that aren't sympathetic to that, but I think the great bulk of the professors in the professional schools are vigorously opposed to that. I know this is true of our School of Agriculture. I think it's true of our School of Engineering, School of Pharmacy, Home Economics. In the main, that's not where the trouble has not come from those sources. They're here for business. They think students should be here for business. That's beyond the serious business of education. They oppose it.
Well, while we're on the Purdue faculty, are there any men who you would call great men in this university that have influenced you and you've had the privilege of working with and associating with in various capacities?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mentioned Dr. Elliott, of course, who was my college president, my president during my early years on the staff, a tremendous fellow in many, many respects. I put Fred Hovde in this category, for I rate Fred Hovde as an absolutely tremendous person, a package. There are some things about him that I like less than others, but that's true of all of us. You take a man as a package, and as a package, he is a terrific individual. I had some association with Dave Ross. I go back to Dave as an undergraduate student and as an early staff member and was frequently in committee meetings with Dave. I rate him as one of the all-time Purdue greats. Dean Potter, I knew, was an undergraduate student. I was an ag student. He was an engineer, but I got acquainted with the dean. And as a young staff member, I was with the dean often. And even now, as a matter of fact, the dean and his daughter Helen have invited Mrs. Butts and me to have dinner in their home next Sunday night. Even now, I get a tremendous inspiration from being around that all-time Purdue great, to Dean Potter, to, what is he, 87 or 8 years
88
old?
88, his next birthday.
88, with his mind just going like a dynamo. It's absolutely terrific, as you know. I put him in that category. I mentioned Dean Young. I was very close to Dean Young. He was chairman of my graduate committee. Inspiring chap, a chap who would push responsibility to you faster than you thought you were ready to take it, but he'd push you out and you had to sink or swim, and if you could swim, you learned how to swim fast with him. I'd put him in that category. And some of the trustees, I've known the trustees through the years, are great chaps. I think Maury Kanoy, the present chairman of our board of trustees, is a tremendous chap. Maury and I were in school together. We didn't know each other very well then. But he's in a very difficult situation here now, with the faculty polarized and with the political body in the state yipping at one side and the liberals yipping on the other side. He's in an extremely difficult situation. I think Maury plays his role very, very well.
Do you think of anybody who's been leaders in agriculture in the state?
Oh, yes. The Herschel Newsom, who just died the other day, was master of the National Grange. I knew him when he was active in the Indiana Grange. Hassel Skank, the president of the Farm Bureau for many, many years, and George Dow following him. I've worked very, very closely with them. With Harvey Hull, one of the great leaders in agricultural cooperatives. He's been retired for many years now, but a great philosopher and a great rural leader. Was great. It's been my privilege also to associate with a good many business leaders in this state and throughout the state, and they're terrific people.
As you sit back and look at it now, what ought to be Purdue's role in higher education, and what do you think is the future of higher education as we come to the end of the century?
Well, higher education is going to change, obviously, and we're having some pains right now in the change. We've been through, up until the last couple of years, we've been through a dozen pretty good years in financial support for higher education in the state. We haven't gotten the buildings we wanted, although we've gotten quite a good many around here. But increases have come fairly easily. We've come to the point when professors really had to sacrifice to get along, make both ends meet financially, to the time now when they get along reasonably well and can have a second
car
for their wife.
Let me ask you, do you think there's going to be a great change in the role that Purdue plays in the state with the building and ultimate independence of the off-campus centers?
Yes, but let me come back to this thing here. We've been at a time when Indiana and Purdue University were pretty dominant in the state, and everybody regarded them as being the great state universities. We've seen our two state teachers' colleges become universities, and they're growing relatively faster than we do. I think they're assuming many of the functions that Purdue as a land-grant college assumed for years. We were truly a people's college for many years. We've moved away from that. We've gotten a lot of statistical sophistication. We've developed a strong central core here in humanities and science that didn't come up through the land-grant route. They tend to be more Ivy League-ish. Professors there don't have the concept of public service that we had 20 or 30 years ago in this place. We've gotten admission restrictions now. You've got to be in the top half of your class to get in, or better than that usually. We've become pretty sophisticated. And I think there's very real evidence that the two teachers' colleges, now universities, are picking up some of the land-grant functions we used to perform here. I think you see the regional campus is doing that, where you can be admitted much more easily to the regional campus. You see pressure to meet this need that we've evacuated, and pressure to create community colleges that some other states have. And while we don't have community colleges as such in Indiana, I think we're not very far from it, because that's the trend of the times. And I know we argue that the regional campuses meet this need, because some 90% of our college-age youngsters now live within commuting distance of a college or a community or a regional campus. What this means is that I think the Bloomington and the Lafayette campus will be fairly well restricted in size to their present size, and the legislature will do that not by any ceiling, but just by not providing new buildings. And you got to limit yourself if that's what they do. The growth is going to take place in our regional campuses. They'll be autonomous one of these days. Indianapolis is almost that now, where Purdue and IU have combined down there under Chancellor Maynard Hine. You can't have a concentration of 1 million people as you have in the Calumet area without them having their own university with a full-fledged series of course offerings and graduate opportunities, with their own union building, their own football team and basketball team and the like of that.
That's coming.
This is just a political fact of life. And the same is true of Indianapolis, of Fort Wayne, of South Bend and Evansville. And what that means is that our regional campuses, one of these days, perhaps with the next president of Purdue, will be fairly autonomous, and there'll be a chancellor over each of them, and perhaps a chancellor over the Lafayette campus.
There may be a chancellor of all the Purdue centers.
Then. That's right. And each center will have about the same status as the Lafayette campus has now.
All right. Again, is there anything else that we ought to touch on?
Well, just a bit about the role of public higher education in the remainder of this 20th century. I think we've got to come back to fundamentals, that our role is to teach these students the basic skills and the basic sciences and disciplines they're going to have to be successful. I think sometimes we get these youngsters in college now, and they get in some of these humanities courses where the professor's dealing with the ills of society, with the fact that we need a new constitution in Indiana, as you mentioned a while ago, and we do, with some of the difficulties, the way our Congress operates, and there are difficulties there. They get to talking about remaking the society. This is pretty heady stuff for those youngsters that come in here at 18 years of age with no background in it. And they're carried away with it. I can understand this. But their basic need is to get the fundamentals. They need skills in communication. They need their English. They need a sense of history, the very thing you teach. For history can teach us much and help us to avoid many, many mistakes. They need to develop vocational skills in whatever area they're going to go into. And then I think we need to, along with that, give them a sense of responsible citizenship, a sense of responsible participation in their political parties, to work within the establishment. I know we have everybody saying we've got to listen to this new generation and get what they're trying to tell us, but I'm not at all convinced that the human beings have changed enough that these youngsters are going to run this country now. I think that those of us who've been through it have some wisdom left. And we work within the establishment.
We have some small contribution.
Well, I think we have some small contribution. And I know they talk about in a year or two, half our population is going to be 25 years of age or younger, but two-thirds of them are going to be 20 years of age or younger. And my appraisal of the average 20-year-old is that he's still got a lot of maturing to do. But I think in this role, the role of higher education in this situation is to mature these people, give them a basis for sound judgment, and you get that in the classroom. You don't get it marching in the street. You don't get it being an activist. And then to give them a sense of responsible participation in this important role of citizenship.
I quite agree with you.
But always to remember that the role, that the commodity that the university deals in is truth. Now, I know it's hard to define that. But it's discovery, it's refinement, it's promulgation at a point in time, horizontally to as many people as you can get, vertically through time from generation to generation. We are the custodians of the truth. And we've got to command the respect of the electorate. As we do that, if we become activists, we lose that respect and lose their support. And if we lose their respect and lose their support, then we invite political management and political participation. And we get to the point where we get political management of those who are custodians of the truth, then the truth itself is threatened. And if the university gets to the point that they can't manage it themselves, who in society is left to do it? The last thing in the world we want is political management of our universities. For then the very commodity we deal in is threatened.
I think you're right. I don't know. I don't have too many more years at Purdue, but I'm getting to the place that I find it difficult to understand. So what goes on in the minds of the kids in order to understand how to approach them, because they have the solutions to most problems that I'm still in unsure myself. They have all the solutions. They come out pat, like pat phrases. They sound like a group of, quite frankly, Communist Party members talking a party line. Then if you get down to them, what do they know? Well, once they have given the slogans, there's nothing underneath that. And I think your suggestion is very important.
In many cases, I think we do them a disservice. As I say, we get them in rather immaturely here, and we talk about what's wrong with America, and this is pretty heady stuff to these youngsters. And we ought also to talk about what's right with it. you and I are the first to admit that there are many shortcomings, many things wrong with it. But I've traveled the world a great deal. I've been in 30 nations on 5 continents around this world. I've seen how other systems work and what they've done. And I have yet to see the system that outtrade with what we have here.
There's one thing that we all forget, and that is we are the only people in the world that wash our dirty linen in public. We do that, but we do it in order to get clean linen.
Yeah,
we have a lot. This is what everyone forgets about us.
And we have a lot of clean linen in the closet we ought to hang out once in a while.
You're doggone right. All right, are we through?
All done.
All right, well, thank you. On that note, we'll stop and make the note that this is an interview with Gene Butts and will be used in Purdue University Archives.